Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Today we are going over the Parasha Shemini, which is covering Leviticus 9 through 11. So 9, 10, and 11 we'll be going over today. And we'll be going over the Haftarot, the usual one that's the traditional one that goes along with it, and you'll see why pretty quickly, of 2 Samuel 6 and part of chapter 7 through verse 17. And also another Haftarah will go off on is Acts chapter 10 and 11, which will coincide with our discussion in Leviticus chapter 11. So that is kind of the high point of where we're going at today. And one note here, you might wonder what Haftarah means. Haftarah means kind of like a going off. So people might call it a bird walk, or it's not exactly like a tangent, but it's kind of like another place to go. So if you're seeing, you got your parasha, means your portion reading, and then the Haftarah is like, okay, this is a departure from where you were going before, but it is related. It's not like you're going somewhere that has nothing to do with anything else. So starting into Leviticus chapter 9. Now it came about on the eighth day that Moshe called Aharon and his sons and the elders of Israel. And he said to Aharon, take for yourself a calf, a bull for a sin offering, and a ram for a burnt offering, both without defect, and offer them before the Lord. Then to the sons of Israel you shall speak, saying, take a male goat for a sin offering, and a calf and a lamb, both 1 year old, without defect, for a burnt offering, and an ox and a ram for peace offerings, the sacrifice before the Lord, and a grain offering mixed with oil, for today the Lord will appear to you. So they took what Moshe had commanded to the front of the tent of meeting, and the whole congregation came near and stood before the Lord. Moshe said, this is the thing which the Lord has commanded you to do, that the glory of the Lord may appear to you. Moshe then said to Aharon, come near to the altar and offer your sin offering and your burnt offering, that you may make atonement for yourself and for the people. Then make the offering for the people, that you may make atonement for them, just as the Lord has commanded. So Aharon came near to the altar and slaughtered the calf of the sin offering, which was for himself. Aharon's sons presented the blood to him, and he dipped his finger in the blood and put some on the horns of the altar and poured out the rest of the blood at the base of the altar. The fat and the kidneys and the lobe of the liver of the sin offering, then he offered up in smoke on the altar, just as the Lord had commanded Moshe. The flesh and the skin, however, he burned with fire outside the camp. Then he slaughtered the burnt offering, and Aharon's sons handed the blood to him, and he sprinkled it around the altar. Then he handed the burnt offering to him in pieces with the head, and he offered them up in smoke on the altar. He also washed the entrails and the legs and offered them up in smoke with the burnt offering on the altar. Then he presented the people's offering. He took the goat of the sin offering, which was for the people, and slaughtered it, and offered it for sin, like the first. He also presented the burnt offering, and offered it according to the ordinance. Next, he presented the grain offering, and filled his hand with some of it, and offered it up in smoke on the altar, besides the burnt offering of the morning. Then he slaughtered the ox and the ram, the sacrifice for the peace offerings, which was for the people. And Aharon's sons handed the blood to him, and he sprinkled it around the altar. As for the portions of fat and the ox and the ram, the fat tail and the fat covering, and the kidneys and the lobe of the liver, they now placed the portion of fat on the breasts, and he offered them up in smoke on the altar. But the breast and the right thigh that Aharon presented as a wave offering before the Lord, just as Moshe had commanded. Then Aharon lifted up his hands toward the people and blessed them. And he stepped down after making the sin offering and the burnt offering and the peace offerings. Moshe and Aharon went to the tent of meeting. When they came out and blessed the people, the glory of the Lord appeared to all the people. Then fire came out from before the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the portions of fat on the altar. And when the people saw it, they shouted and fell on their faces. Chapter 10. Now Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aharon, took their respective fire pans, and after putting fire in them, placed incense on it and offered strange fire in front of the Lord, which he had not commanded them. The fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. Then Moshe said to Aharon, "It is what the Lord spoke, saying, 'By those who come near to me, I will be treated as holy, and before all the people, I will be honored.' So Aharon, therefore, kept silent. Moshe called also to Mishael and Elizaphan, the sons of Aharon's uncle Uziel, and said to them, 'Come forward, carry your relatives out from the front of the sanctuary to the outside of the camp.' So they came forward and carried them still in their tunics to the outside of the camp, as Moshe had said. And Moshe said to Aharon and to his sons, Eleazar and Itamar, 'Do not uncover your heads nor tear your clothes, so that you will not die and that he will not become wrathful against all the congregation. But your kinsmen, the whole house of Israel, shall bewail the burning which the Lord has brought about. You shall not even go out from the doorway of the tent of meeting, or you will die, for the Lord's anointing oil is upon you.' So they did according to the word of Moshe. The Lord then spoke to Aharon, saying, 'Do not drink wine or strong drink, neither you nor your sons with you, when you come into the tent of meeting, so that you will not die. It is a perpetual statute throughout your generations. And so, to make a distinction between the holy and the profane, and between the unclean and the clean, and so as to teach the sons of Israel all the statutes which the Lord has spoken to them through Moshe.' Then Moshe spoke to Aharon and to his surviving sons, Eleazar and Itamar, 'Take the grain that is left over from the Lord's offerings by fire and eat it unleavened beside the altar, for it is most holy. You shall eat it, moreover, in a holy place, because it is your due and your son's due out of the Lord's offerings by fire. For thus I have been commanded. The breast of the wave offering, however, and the thigh of the offering you may eat in a clean place, you and your sons and your daughters with you. For they have been given as your due and your son's due out of the sacrifices and the peace offerings for the sons of Israel. The thigh offered up by lifting up, the breast offered by waving, they shall bring along with the offerings by fire of the portions of fat to present as a wave offering before the Lord. So it shall be a thing perpetually due you and your sons with you, just as the Lord has commanded.' But Moshe searched carefully for the goat of the sin offering, and behold, it had been burned up. So he was angry with Aharon's surviving sons, Eleazar and Itamar, saying, 'Why did you not eat the sin offering at the holy place? For it is most holy, and he gave it to you to bear away the guilt of this congregation, to make atonement for them before the Lord. Behold, since its blood had not been brought inside into the sanctuary, you should certainly have eaten it in the sanctuary, just as I commanded.' But Aharon spoke to Moshe, 'Behold, this very day they presented their sin offering and their burnt offerings before the Lord. When things like this happened to me, if I had eaten a sin offering today, would it have been good in the sight of the Lord?' When Moshe heard that, it seemed good in his sight." Chapter 11. The Lord spoke again to Moshe and to Aharon, saying to them, "Speak to the sons of Israel, saying, These are the creatures which you may eat from all the animals that are on the earth. Whatever divides the hoof, thus making split hoofs and chews the cud among the animals, that you may eat. Nevertheless, you are not to eat of these, among those that chew the cud, or among those which divide the hoof. A camel, for though it chews cud, it does not divide the hoof. It is unclean to you. Likewise, the chiffon, for it chews cud, but it does not divide the hoof. It is unclean to you. The rabbit also, for though it chews cud, it does not divide the hoof. It is unclean to you. And the pig, for though it divides the hoof, thus making a split hoof, it does not chew cud. It is unclean to you. You shall not eat of their flesh, nor touch their carcasses. They are unclean to you. These you may eat, whatever is in the water, all that is fins and scales, those in the water, in the seas or in the rivers, you may eat. But whatever is in the seas and in the rivers that does not have fins and scales among all the teeming life of the water and among all of the living creatures that are in the water, they are detestable things to you. And they shall be abhorrent to you. You may not eat of their flesh, and their carcasses you shall detest. Whatever in the waters does not have fins and scales is abhorrent to you. These, moreover, you shall detest among the birds. They are abhorrent, not to be eaten. The eagle and the vulture and the buzzard and the kite and the falcon in its kind, every raven in its kind, and the ostrich and the owl and the seagull and the hawk in its kind, and the little owl and the cormorant and the great owl and the white owl and the pelican and the carrion vulture and the stork, the heron in its kinds and the hoopoe and the bat. All the winged insects that walk on all fours are detestable to you. Yet these you may eat of all the winged insects which walk on all fours, those which have above their feet jointed leg with which to jump on the earth. These of them you may eat, the locust in its kinds and the devastating locust in its kinds, the cricket in its kinds and the grasshopper in its kinds. But all other winged insects which are four-footed are detestable to you. By these, moreover, you will make unclean. You will be made unclean. Whoever touches their carcasses becomes unclean until evening. And whoever picks up any of their carcasses shall wash his clothes and be unclean until evening. Concerning all the animals which divide the hoof, but do not make the split hoof, or which do not chew cud, they are unclean to you. Whoever touches them becomes unclean. Also, whatever walks on its paws among all the creatures that walk on all fours are unclean to you. Whoever touches their carcasses becomes unclean until evening. And the one who picks up their carcasses shall wash his clothes and be unclean until evening. They are unclean to you. Now these are to you the unclean among the swarming thing that swarm on the earth, the mole and the mouse and the great lizard and its kinds, and the gecko and the crocodile and the lizard, and the sand reptile and the chameleon. These are to you the unclean among the swarming things. Whoever touches them, when they are dead, becomes unclean until evening. Also, anything on which any one of them may fall when they are dead becomes unclean, including any wooden article or clothing or a skin or a sack or any article of which use is made, it shall be put in the water and be unclean until evening. Then it becomes clean. As for any earthenware vessel into which one of them may fall, whatever is in it becomes unclean, and you shall break the vessel. Any of the food which may be eaten on which water comes shall be unclean. And any liquid which may be drunk in any vessel shall become unclean. Everything, moreover, on which part of their carcasses may fall becomes unclean. An oven or stove shall be smashed. They are unclean and shall continue to as unclean to you. Nevertheless, a spring or a cistern collecting water shall be clean. though the one who touches their carcass shall be unclean. If a part of their carcass falls on any seed for sowing, which is to be sown, it is clean. Though if water is put on the seed, and a part of their carcass falls on it, it is unclean to you. Also, if one of the animals dies which you have for food, the one who touches its carcass becomes unclean until evening. He too, who eats some of its carcass shall wash his clothes and be unclean until evening. The one who picks up its carcass shall wash his clothes and be unclean until evening. Now every swarming thing that swarms on the earth is detestable, not to be eaten. Whatever crawls on its belly, whatever walks on all fours, whatever has many feet, in respect to every swarming thing that swarms on the earth, you shall not eat them, for they are detestable. Do not render yourselves detestable through any of the swarming things that swarm, and you shall not make yourselves unclean with them so that you become unclean. For I am the Lord your God. Consecrate yourselves, therefore, and be holy, for I am holy. And you shall not make yourselves unclean with any of the swarming things that are on the earth. For I am the Lord your God who brought you up out of the land of Egypt to be your God. Thus you shall be holy. Excuse me. For I am holy. This is the law regarding the animal and the bird and every living thing that moves in the waters and everything that swarms on the earth. To make a distinction between the clean and the unclean, and between the edible creature and the creature which is not to be eaten. Okay, we got a question right off here.
I've been wondering about the dietary stuff for quite a while. Is all this fast food and stuff, is that considered unclean?
All this fast food stuff?
You know,
what do you mean?
Fast food stuff like McDonald's and all these restaurants. Because I know that I'm wondering if I'm just having back thoughts, if perhaps that's just God trying to say something to me. Can you enlighten me on fast foods and should that be treated like an unclean food? And actually, I don't even know what I'm trying to ask.
So what is it specifically about fast food that you're wondering about?
Is it unclean?
Oh, so you're wondering about just in general, unclean? Well, from this, from what you were reading here would make you think that something was unclean or not?
What it is people say something to me. That somebody told me that the food from McDonald's is horse meat.
Oh, they tell you it's horse meat.
Somebody said it was horse meat.
Ah.
And I said, horse is an unclean animal, right?
Yeah, that would be.
So
I guess it would be a good pop quiz here. Why is a horse unclean? What's its hoof look like?
It's not split.
There you go.
Yes,
so it's got one hoof. So that's one of the key distinguishing things there. And as far as, you know, if it is actually horse meat or something that in any particular place, then that would be the case. However, there's also something very curious that both the Apostle Paul and the Apostle Yaakov, or James, said. Paul mentions this in Romans 14, and it's listed in James, I think it's what, chapter 2 or chapter 3. I'm kind of foggy on that, but he mentions that in chapter 14, for someone who thinks, Paul calls it weak in faith, and they think that something is, you could say it would be in those categories we're going to be getting to of tahor or tameh. If it's in one of those bad categories or good categories and you think it's that way, then you should treat it that way. So until you know absolutely for sure, because otherwise, you know, the Apostle Yaakov goes into this. It's like, you know, if you think something is a sin, it is a sin. Why? Did your thinking it make it into a sin? No, but for you to be then going against that would be rebellion against God unless you are fully convinced in your own mind. Kind of something that yes, we have a question over there.
Well, yeah, you know, if looking at that, then none of us would be wanting to go to restaurants because, you know, they will be making pork along with everything else utensil-wise. You know, their utensils are definitely not clean, touching those things. So it is a matter of faith, or you know, how many can find a kosher restaurant anywhere?
Yeah, because you know that's one of the things that some people will look for is they'll look for a kosher restaurant that will then separate ovens, stoves, kitchenware, dishes, everything separate, not just for what we're talking about here, but for some of the extrapolations upon kosher that have come into that CODIS.
We read.
Yeah, chapter 9.
All of these things are taking place the same day. I mean, you know, so many consumed pieces of animals and everything burning up. It's all this within the same day. And,
yeah, it might kind of remind you of another case of a similar situation, and that would be the day of the commemoration of the temple there in mentioned in 1 Samuel. It was a whole lot more than this.
Oh, yeah.
And that was all the same day.
And even though God's Spirit had come in and the cloud had covered the spot where the Lord was meeting, the meeting place and all like that, those two sons of Aaron, they just lit their censers up and just ran on in there. And maybe the others even didn't even know what they were doing. They just came. They just decided that they had to have talked it over or something, that they would just...
Yeah, so the question is that what made those two just think that they could do that? Were they working under a misconception or a partial conception? So it'd be something we'll take a look at in more detail. But that's a good question. So it's like, you know, did they know? What did they know, and when did they know it? Yes.
My question is, how come the people would have been punished for something that the priest did?
In which
in,
case?
In 10:6, it said, "And Moshe said to Aharon and to Eleazar and to Ithamar, his sons, do not unbind your heads nor tear your garments, lest you die, and wrath come upon all the people. But let your brothers, all the house of Israel, bewail the burning which Yahuwah has kindled."
Oh, that's a pretty good question there. So about why would the congregation be punished for if they went themselves outside of it? Because you're thinking about, this kind of goes into our context of where we get back into this passage, but I guess a little preview of coming attractions would be, is how does the congregation get access to the temple and into, or the tabernacle and into God's presence? It's through the priesthood. And they... It talks about the anointing oil being on their heads. That's kind of the previous chapter we're looking at in like Leviticus 8 and such. But this oil is the kind of the setting aside. They were Mashiach'd, set aside to be this role of helping the people get access to the presence of God. If they then basically shirked their duty, their first duty, which is to the people, then you're basically leaving the people without access to God. So, yeah. So that's where the seriousness of that comes down. We'll talk a little bit more about that as we get into it. But yeah, it's a pretty serious thing that they would have left the people without. Any other observations of passage here before we get going too much further? All right. Well, just starting a little bit of context here in our parasha. The parasha Shemini covers chapters 9 through 11, and where this kind of bridges into two general parts of the book of Leviticus or Vayikra, it's coming from the portion there talking about where the institution of the priesthood gets started, which is back in chapter 8 and goes through chapter 10, where it talks about, you know, the setting aside of the priesthood. So that's kind of happening in chapter 8, where our last parasha left off with the setting aside of the priesthood. And this is picking up, okay, they've been set aside. Now it's time for them to get to work doing something. which is where chapter 9 comes in and goes through chapter 10. And then in chapter 11, all the way through chapter 15, really, is talking about the laws of clean and unclean. What is clean? What is unclean? Going through that whole section. So that's where the parasha then extends into. So it's starting our look into what is clean and what is unclean. So going back to where this starts out to begin with, there, our passage here is called Shemini because of the first words that we have in chapter 9 that came about on the eighth day, which is eighth. The eighth day of Shemini means eighth. So just a little bit of a look on the name of this, because it actually fits a little bit into the theme of what this whole parasha is about. And you often have heard a bit about where, you know, eight means new beginnings. Well, we'll talk a little bit about why, what makes people think that it means new beginnings. Well, Shemini means eighth, and the word that we would use as eight itself is Shemona, or Shemone, depending on how you pronounce the last vowel there. And that Shemone comes from the verb shaman. Shaman is something that means to be fat, to be full, to be plenty. There are various ways that that verb is used. It also is the idea of something reaching its fullness. So that's kind of, you could say, extrapolate the meaning out of shaman into a greater meaning. So the root meaning, the root verb is something that's like filling up, and not only just filling up, but like almost pretty much bursting out. And that's, or flowing over, it might be another way you could kind of illustrate that. It was kind of the way of shaman, something that's like filling up and flowing over. So thus, that's kind of the beginning part of where you start with this look at what is it that's filling up. So with seven, the where we have the Shavua, and where we get then the term of sevens from, that's, you could say, reaching its completeness. That's where you also get the word of like an oath. If you have a Shiva, you're making an oath. You're making, this is certainly going to happen. So thus we get seven means completeness. Because if it's connected to a seven, that means it's going to happen. But this, Shemone, is now, it's now reached completeness and then more so. So it's gone beyond the completeness, gone beyond that even further. So just a couple of instances where you get Shemone or Shemini kind of comes into play in that. Some places where you see eight or even the eighth day show up throughout Scripture. One of the first you'll see in Genesis chapter 7 is we're talking about the flood. And it talks about there were eight people in the ark. Okay, you might say, okay, that's just a historical note there. But in 1 Peter chapter 3, it notes that's in a particular context, that there was eight people who went in the ark and then went out the other side. So this is, humanity has now come to the completeness of that generation, and the eight are now going out the other side into the new generation, the new after the flood. So you get that kind of picture of, it was certainly a new beginning for Hanoch or Noah and his family. And, you know, actually, it was even more than that. It was, you know, genetically, when you look back and you trace things like the X chromosome and the mitochondrial DNA and such, one of the things that make people scratch their head a little bit genetically is there is only one X chromosome in the world whatsoever. That is, meaning there's only one man and his family that everybody comes from. Everywhere. And the other one is that there's three DNA, mitochondrial DNA lines, which come from the mother. So you're talking about three basic women involved. And some people have parsed it down even further to the point where one of them appears to be a very close clone mutation of the other. So you could say four, but really there's three. So yeah, when they or sisters, you could say that one of those sisters or the wives of the sons of Noah was likely there were two sisters involved in there somewhere. So that's where you get basically four women or three families that they came from, you could say. Yeah, so you could say that there was a genetic bottleneck. So for genetically also, it was a new beginning for humanity after the flood. Kind of fast forwarding down to Genesis 17 and Genesis 21, you see there with the commands to Abraham on circumcising on the eighth day. And this was something started going forward. You're going to circumcise on the eighth day, because this was a new beginning, really, for humanity. Instead of, okay, now talking through specific people, now God was separating out a people to himself and a line, a family line. Out of all the families on the earth, he was separating out one family to be, you could say, the brokers, the representatives, the ambassadors to all humanity through Abraham and his family. Then fast forwarding further, down to Exodus 22, you have, and it's kind of like the parallel to what we're looking at today, is that these Exodus 22 is a bit of a parallel of what we're looking at here today, is that it mentions that these sacrifices to start off the tabernacle were done on the eighth day. So kind of Leviticus 9 and Exodus 22 are kind of looking at similar events. And then you... we've got the passage we're looking at today, and then if you fast forward even further, where we'll get to eventually sometime soon, talking about Leviticus 23 and the Moedim, or the appointed times, the memorials of the Lord, and you have in there talking about Shemini Etzeret. So Shemini meaning eighth, and Etzeret meaning a convocation, a special meeting. So thus, the Shemini Etzeret means the convocation of the eighth day. And that's, it's talking about that in Leviticus 23, about in the context of the eighth day of Sukkot. Well, Sukkot's only 7 days. Well, yeah, it's seven plus one. And kind of the mirror image of the unleavened bread and Passover, which is seven plus one. As Passover spills over into an eighth day, this time in the front end of the 7 days. So you got 7 days of unleavened bread, and then the one before that, in the 14th day, is the kind of the eighth day part of that. And then at the end of the cycle with Sukkot, you've got the 7 days of Sukkot, and then the eighth day. So it's kind of an interesting cycle that it's not like, okay, this is just kind of something slapped onto the end of it. But this is something that was a significant event, because unlike with unleavened bread, where you've got a convocation on the first day and a convocation on the last day of it, a Shabbat on the first day of unleavened bread and a Shabbat day on the last day of unleavened bread, with Sukkot and Shemini Atzeret, you've got one on the first day, but instead of one on the seventh day, you've got one on this eighth day. It's something that is gone beyond those 7 days. Yes, you had a question?
I just want to say I learned something. Like, you take the menorah, and each number of the menorah, you put all the seven feasts, and you count one plus seven is eight, six is eight, three plus five is eight, and then four times each side, fall and feast, two times four is eight. Mm. They all add up to eight. Eight days. I was just so enamored in each feast. And then this side of the menorah, the fall, and this side of the spring and the fall. You're saying that word. I heard that word. And then there'll be common ground between the two, which has to do with the eighth. Mm-hmm. The eighth day. And it was just... to me, I thought, oh my gosh, incredible. the eighth day.
Yeah. Well, which is why that both unleavened bread and Sukkot start on a full moon. It is the moon reaches its fullness. On the 15th day, the moon is full. So, no coincidences here. Yeah, exactly. So, that's kind of some more meanings of where things reach their fullness on the eighth day. One of the things that you have with this commemoration of, talking about Shemini Atzeret specifically, is that Sukkot is a memorial of what? Why? What is one of the key reasons of why a sukkah? Remember that you, when you were coming through, were dwelling in tents. So we have a question down front here. Yes. Yeah, so you got full moons on the 15th day of the first month, 15th day of the seventh month.
Isn't that we're celebrating when we get to tabernacle with Heavenly Father when He comes back?
So you could say that's the end goal there. But one of the things that you have pictured is that you are, in talking about tabernacling with God, okay, that's the end goal, but the first part was the remember that you were dwelling in booths during this journey, okay? But what happened after the journey? They crossed over the Yarden, the Jordan, and then they went into the land, and that's where they found their permanent home, the permanent place where they could rest. They weren't wandering anymore. They now went to a place where they rest. So that's why when you get into Hebrews 3 and 4 and Psalm 95, it talks about entering God's rest. This picture of crossing over, entering the land, going from the wandering, going to the place of rest, entering God's rest. So thus, one of the things that you have with Sukkot and then Shemini Atzeret is a memorial, really, of entering God's rest. So when you look about into the way future of, Revelation 21, 22, the dwelling place of God is with man, the great thing of that, but came sooner than that, prophesied through the prophets, Yeshayahu or Isaiah being specifically talking about Emmanuel, God with us, that came sooner than that with Yeshua, that you have the tabernacling of God with man, as the Apostle Yaakov talks about that. So those are some waypoints that we would say as to, okay, this is something reaching its fullness and spilling over. So the context of this is beginning a section here in chapter 9, you're starting in here talking about, okay, priesthood, you've been told what to do on how to do it up from chapter 1 through chapter 7 of these are the different offerings that you give and this is when you do it and how you do it and such. And then chapter 8 is the commissioning period, the 7 days you're going to be commissioning the priesthood. Now the eighth day is, okay, now it's time to start. So one of the things, if you might recall when we went back through Parasha Vayikra, Vayikra or Leviticus book starts with this interesting problem, which is left over from the last chapter of Exodus. And that problem that's left at the end of Exodus is God moves in, everybody gets out. Now how do you get back in? So basically everyone is now barred, even Moshe and Aharon, they had to leave. Everybody had to leave. How do you get back into the presence of God? So thus, chapters 1 through 7 are the discussions of the korbanot. And we talked about that, just a little bit of a refresher on that. Korban, what we talk about is korban is what's translated offer is offering or sacrifice, and it comes from the verb karab. And karab means to draw near, to bring near, depending on if it's passive or an active sort of verb on that, to go near to something, to go toward something. So korban, which is the noun form of that, is this is the thing that is brought near, or the thing that brings near, or the thing that is brought near. So that is what the korban is. So thus, you're talking about all this stuff in chapters 1 through 7 is, these are the things that bring you near. And as a bit of a refresher from our first parasha there, that the people, when they come in the door, and they bring their offerings, and they bring their korbanot, this is the thing that's going to approach, they themselves cannot go in. Because one of the things you're looking at with this, left over from the last part of Exodus into Vayikra, is that you're almost looking at a, you could say, a hazardous zone. This is a really a hazardous zone. We can call it waste because presence of God is not waste. But it is like, you know, you're talking about like a nuclear reactor here. Everybody had to get out because they just started it up. It's now active. So what do you have to do to get back into it? You know, you watch movies and stuff about if there's some sort of a situation where people have to put on the suits, and then you have to go through the decontamination, going in and coming out. Very meticulous. You have to pay attention. You cannot be snoozing any bit of the way in there or coming out, because if you do, you could get contaminated or die. Especially if you're talking about, if it's something highly infectious, we were talking about Ebola earlier or something that moves fast. If you get exposed to it, you're toast. And similar with radiation, depending on how strong it is and such, you could be toast if you get exposed to that. You know, we might look at this and think this is really weird, this all this stuff going on here, but what this is a big lesson in is that the presence of God, we call it holy, we call it sanctified, but those are big words that really mean other, separate, and stuff. You know, we think of today, we send out a probe and we send spacecraft out there. Well, if you send spacecraft out outside our atmosphere and outside of our, you know, we got this little, God made a great protective shield around our planet, our magnetosphere and such to keep all the harmful stuff out. But once you get outside of that, you know, it is like being standing in front of a microwave, because a really big microwave. Because the sun is death. You know, one of the things that they've discovered, we watch all these sci-fi shows of people zooming here, zooming there, and the spacecraft. Well, they figured out that that doesn't work quite that way. Because once you get outside of our atmosphere, unless you got a whole lot of shielding going on, a trip to Mars, you'd be cooked. You're toast. You're going to be dead by the time you get there because of the radiation involved. So, you know, we have a small example of that with our sun, and we think, oh, okay, well, that's just the way things are. Well, we're talking about the creator of the universe deciding to show up on our planet, wanting to get close to us, but coming in contact with something like that, totally other and separate. So how do you teach something like that? Leviticus. That's what we're getting at here, is you are approaching not only just the physical world into something that is deadly to the physical world, but you're also going into a realm that is wholly different, thinks totally different than the world around you. You know, when you see the reflections and the teachings of the Messiah and such, you're thinking, wow, this is a lot of thinking that's totally different from how we might naturally, quote, naturally respond to things, or how people, you know, respond if they're just left without any sort of big moral guide. Well, you're moving from that world into a world that is working on a strong moral fiber, a strong and wise moral fiber that knows how things should work, how they work best, how they work with the least amount of pain in your life, the least amount of falling down and hitting your face on the pavement, you know, figuratively in your world, you know, falling down all the time. Well, yes.
And I don't mean that for him.
Both physically and morally to us. That's what holy and sanctified means. It's like totally, totally separate. And the whole thing of that lesson of Leviticus 1 through 7 is all about wow, God is so far separate from us physically and morally that we have to be very careful to follow how he says to approach him, how to karab him. It's all about drawing near. Because God is not vindictive. If that was so, he would have said, get out. This is going to be this nice tent. It's going to glow at night. It's going to be great. Just sit there and maybe get out your marshmallows and cook them on it. But you're not ever going in there again. You're not ever going to have any contact with whoever's in there. That is just going to be the end of it. But no, he's saying, all right, the presence of the creator of heaven and earth is going to be here in your midst, in the dead center of your camp. But he wants to actually have contact with you. But you have to be very careful about how you're doing, just don't waltzing in there. So, yes.
It reminds me of the story of Esther and how just, you can't just go and approach the king. You need protocol, because if you don't have protocol, he's not going to receive you. In fact, you may get killed. So.
So one of the things that we look at in this is really a training. When we talk about Torah as the lesson, the instruction, this is big time instruction about how you are lifted up to God's level. God has come down in the midst of mankind, but he's put a big wall of protection around himself to keep from basically destroying everything around it. So you could say is like God has come down and built a giant protective thing around him, and those are the various things that you see related to the tabernacle. Yes?
I was just thinking, you know, I mean, he shows us that in every part of life. I know with these grains, I'm making these keeper grains, and so they're talking about if your hands aren't sterilized, you can introduce bacteria. And he shows us, you know, when he taught us how to... all applications of life, like how we garden and how we do the soil, everything is there. And the more that's revealed, we're going to say, oh my goodness, I had no idea. Teaching us in daily life that he has, you know, shown us how to do that. Because we can introduce bad, which humans have done that, you know. And I just thought that when you were saying that about these grains, like they want your hands all clean, the jar all clean. Because, you know, I'm going to take that stuff in, the drink. And if I introduce some kind of odd bacteria in it, you know, it's like cross-contamination. I learned that in nursing school.
Pay attention to your processes.
You know?
Yes.
Yeah,
that's you know, it is interesting when you talk about nursing and you talk about sterile fields.
Yeah.
You know, when you think about that in those professions where sterility, if you're talking about healthcare, but also in high tech, you know, if you're, we all, are wonderful. Computers are wonderful, but wow, if you've ever seen how they're built, talk about clean rooms and such. There's a lot of sterility and very much a lot of care, not only of little grains of dust, dirt, oils of your fingers, but also static electricity, all kinds of stuff that can just blow up these wonderful things that people have created. So you know, we think about so many things in our lives that you realize that you have to go through a very specific way to deal with it. And then we just think, wow, we can just go in. Now, the one thing, we're going to be getting there, but in Hebrews, and Paul talks a lot about this, is that to approach God with confidence and boldness. But, that's one of the big lessons of Leviticus chapter 10, is confidence and boldness is not brashness and arrogance. And that's one of those big lessons that is held here in this lesson. So one of those, just last key point on chapter 9 before we go into chapter 10, is you might note if you've been paying close attention, I know there's a whole lot of details in there, but just if you want to take another look again, compare chapter 9 with chapter 4, and you'll Leviticus chapter 9 with Leviticus chapter 4, and you'll notice that some of the offerings offered are quite different, especially in where they're offered, the fact that they haven't gone into the tabernacle. They talk about they offer these things at the altar. You might remember when we were talking earlier about the design of the tabernacle, those are like These are like decontamination zones. You go in, you've got zone number one, which is the outer court. First you have the court, you only go in one way into the court, and you go in there with your korban, and then you offer it there, and it is offered at the altar. And then there's the washings and stuff, and one offering or one korban or another may go in and be taken into the second zone, which is, some people call it like the holy place, and that's where the menorah and the altar of incense and then the table with the bread on it is. And then you could say zone three, often called like the most holy place or the holy of holies. That's of course where the Ark of the Testimony is. And that's, you know, kind of the topic potentially of chapter 10, but certainly of chapter 16. Okay. Yes, yeah, yeah, question.
Find out, okay, the kidneys and the livers and the entrails, these are, I mean, to me when I was reading that, they're all filters, like your kidneys filter out impurities. So I was wondering what you knew about those, you have to take all those out and wash them and then put those entrails. What does that represent? I mean, the liver, I know, is the main filter in us. And so what?
Shaman. Everything that reaches its fullness, all the fat, talks a lot about fat and stuff like that. The internal stuff, because one of the things that you'll see in this, people, shaman or fatness is referred to sometimes the fatness of the belly. And that's, sometimes you'll see it, shaman is also talked about, you might see it translated in various ways, like their ears are dull. Well, literally it says their ears are fat. So it's an interesting thing that it's reached its fullness, but it's almost become a bit lethargic. So the reaching its fullness can be a good thing or it could be a bad thing. It's how much has it gone? Because one of those things you might have seen is, you know, their wickedness has not reached its fullness, talking about the land of Canaan and whatever. Well, that fullness is certainly not a good thing, but it had reached its fullness. It's gone to up to its completeness and flowed over. So it's reaching its fullness and being plenty can be a good thing or a bad thing, depending on what it is you're getting filled up with. Yes, Anne, you have a question over there.
So is the liver considered like a fat?
Well, when you want to try to not get too graphic here, but if you've ever sort of
because the whole animal is clean, I mean, right?
When they're talking about washing, they want to make sure that there's no digestive residuals
that go to
the altar and such. Yes.
But I'm looking at the whole, you know, the whole cow is clean. The innards are clean too for consumption. I mean,
they're clean.
We don't like liver. Most people don't like it.
So it's just one of those lessons of the things that are like into the shaman territory, and God defines. You'll see it often defined in there the fat covering this, the fat covering that, and kidneys and livers are often into that general category. It's like those are things that are given over to God because of the lesson of the shaman and the fullness and the plenty of it. So that's one of those lessons. And the main point I was getting to on comparing Leviticus 4 and here in Leviticus 9 is you'll notice that that some of the things that talk about picking blood in and sprinkling it in front of the veil, that stuff doesn't happen. And you'll see later on in chapter 9, chapter 9, verse 23. Moshe and Aaron went into the tent of meeting. So all that stuff that they were doing at the sacrifices was all outside of the, you could say, the main part of it. So they weren't even going into it yet. And one of those things you might say is that the reason for those differences was because there was the korban was not fully complete. The way in was not fully then realized. Once all that was done for the grand opening of the tabernacle, you might say, then the priesthood was able to go in to the tabernacle. The way in was made complete. You might start ringing some bells on a lot of things that the Apostle Paul talks about, and you hear in Hebrews and stuff about the way in has been secured. Now that way in gets further, you know, you could say, foreshadowed, or get a preview of coming distractions on that in Leviticus chapter 16 of a lot of what you see in Hebrews about going through the veil being realized. But this is a first part of that coming in and approaching close to God. So let's go into chapter 10 here now at this point. And chapter 10, we get some people might say it just seems a bit capricious. It's like, well, what did they do? It seems like they were going in to perform duties and kind of doing some duties of a priest. And yet you see this happen. And one of those key things that people throughout a long period of time have keyed in on is the various translations might describe it differently, strange fire or forbidden fire or a foreign fire or something of that sense. Yes, we have a question down here.
Well, he obviously didn't follow the instructions that was given to him. Otherwise, they wouldn't have died.
Okay, something not instructions not given to them. We get a little bit of a clue, and I know this is a preview of coming attractions, but we get a clue as to what this strange fire is over at the beginning part, first verse of chapter 16. Yeah, Leviticus chapter 16. It says, "Now the Lord spoke to Moshe after the death of his two sons of Aharon when they had approached the presence of the Lord and died. And the Lord said to Moshe, 'Tell your brother Aharon that he shall not enter at any time into the holy place inside the veil before the mercy seat, which is on the ark, or he will die. For I will appear in the cloud over the mercy seat.'" Now, it doesn't say specifically as to if they had done that, but one of the key lessons that you're getting back here in chapter 10 is that these folks drew near. They went in and drew near to God in apparently a fashion. Now, whether it was at a different time than what was going to be explained later on here in chapter 16 than what God was saying, but you get some clues of this. Some people have even extrapolated this further based on some other things that you might have noticed in chapter 10 about instructions for priests about, you know, this is specifically related to the mourning, but not uncovering their heads and going out of the doorway. Those are things you might associate with mourning, but talking about in verse 9 about do not drink wine or strong drink, either you or your sons, when you come into the tent of meeting, whether you die. And some people have tried to say, well, maybe that was what was going on. You see later on in Israel's history an account of that there were some drunk priests on duty that were getting a little bit too friendly with some of the women who were coming to worship, to the point where people didn't want to go in anymore to the house of God. So the priests were becoming a curse rather than a blessing to the people. So that certainly did happen later on in Israel's history. Yes, we have a question down here.
I can kind of see that point because my boss has this habit.
Are drunk people come into her office?
No.
Oh, I was going to say, wow.
If one of his staff, one of his, the people under whom he has authority and teaching, you know, he's there to kind of teach them and guide them. If one of them has made some kind of error, he will send out, rather than just telling them you've erred in X, Y, and Z, he will actually send out an email to everybody in the unit reminding them of whatever it is, like, Like if you don't send out a particular letter and you're required to send out a particular letter and he notices that one of the staff have not sent out those letters, rather than just rebuking that person, he rebukes the whole unit and sends out a reminder to everybody, remember, don't forget to do blah, 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 blah. So when you see these, and when people are trying to figure out what do these boys do? What did they do? And then when you see these rebukes, I can see why people would say, well, that must have been what they had done, because you see the rebuke right thereafter, because I know that's how my boss rebukes people. If one person makes a mistake, he sends out a reminder to everybody, even people who have never made that mistake. By the way, don't make this mistake.
Yeah. And you could say that perhaps what you see in chapter 16 with the Yom HaKippurim, the Day of Atonement instructions, that perhaps that is what was involved, because it talks about that they took their censers and they took incense from the altar of incense, put it on there, and went to offer before the Lord. Well, when you read chapter 16, that is what is done at the Day of Atonement. You do that, then you go inside the veil. So, who knows? Maybe that is you're supposed to put incense on the coals that are coming in. Yeah. Because that's, when you read chapter 16, you'll see that that is a part of the approaching God. You're supposed to have this billowing of incense cloud that goes up in front of you. Is, you could see is a bit of a, still a little bit of a barrier between yourself and the presence of God, which is there above the Ark of the Testimony. So that's one of the things that we see, is that this incident is tied a lot to the Day of Atonement, and that when we talk about these zones of how you approach God, that care has to go in all year long. You just don't go totally into the presence of God. There is only one time a year when anyone, and there is only one person who is able to go in all the way into the presence of God. Yes, you have a comment down here.
I was watching some people praying, and it was some sort of a spiritual warfare thing, but the way they were praying, I thought was not okay. They were saying, ordering God to do something right now, and let the, you know, it was like everybody was chiming in and ordering God and bossing him around. I just felt like they were, I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
Used to pray that way. Yeah.
And you have to remember about the, I guess it goes into what we were talking about before, about approaching God with boldness and confidence versus arrogance. Now, it's a lot about the heart of the person, because when you read all of the Psalms and even some of the interactions between, you know, you could say that, Abraham was a lot more congenial in how he was approaching his dialogue with God over Sodom and Gomorrah. But when you read the Psalms, it's like, wow, there are some of those things that you would sound pretty forceful in directing God to do something about this or that. But one of those things that you always have to look at in that, and you'll see kind of hints of them in the Psalms themselves, is that waiting on God to actually do these things. You're, you know, directing, this is, you're saying that this has to be done, but realizing that it is God who does these things. So when you read like the Psalms of David, and he's talking about, you know, take down these evil people who are attacking me and chasing me and lying about me and such. Yet you see in the narrative accounts that he had a well opportunity to take out Saul, and he didn't, because he said, this is God's territory. God has anointed him, and I'm not going to remove him. So that's like where you have to take that balance. It's like, okay, God, do this. But realize, ultimately, who is in charge and who is actually going to make the decision to do that. It's not like the gods of the nations, where you offer up this, offer up that, and then, you know, pull the handle and out comes the jackpot. This is you're talking again about approaching into the otherness of God, and God will decide to act if it's in the best interest that he sees. We talk about God's will, God's foresight, if he's going to make this happen or not. So that's where you have to approach this, because one person can bring a korban in and it's accepted. Another person will bring it in and God says, get this out of my face. Don't ever bring it again. I hate it. But what's the difference? It's all internal, what's happening inside that person who's bringing it. Same can happen with prayer, you know. It goes from, music to God's ear, so to speak, to, you know, meaningless rambling, babbling, you know, don't approach with lots of words kind of thing. So you had a comment?
Oh, yeah. I was learning that the second generation of disciples, that because of the Christians coming in and all the pagan rituals, you know, that's what's happened, like, with us, is that, in, you know, when Constantine brought in, don't do this and all the stuff with the Jews, but when they started to bring in, they wanted more converts. And because they did this, inviting all the pagans in is where so much confusion and, you know, even now, how to approach God, you know. And so we have all kinds of denominations and sects on that, you know. So, I know because you lose that and they say, oh, well, the Bible was written by man. But this is how he's asking us to approach him in the Old Testament, right?
Mm-hmm. Well,
and then Jesus Christ, the Messiah, is the way we get to approach him today.
Yeah, again, you know, it's one of those things that God's approach has not changed as far as the Korban, the method for approaching them. It's just we need to keep in mind the full context of what these Korban are.
I think
they're not tokens at the casino.
Right, right.
They are what God is trying to teach about what is really going on.
Right. I think
so
that's what's happened.
When the reality of what the Korban are all about is here, thus you've got that true way in through the veil.
Is that the reverence part of the is reverence, right?
Yeah.
I mean, what he says.
And
this is majorly...
You know, we talked about this before when we were going through the explaining a lot about what the Korban were, is that, wow, and saw it again here, is that it seems pretty disgusting, especially in our sensibilities of more urbanized culture, a little bit of separation from agriculture and not understanding and being around the slaughtering of animals a lot. It's pretty horrific to our sensibility. But we should never lose our, reverence, should never lose that reverence of what it is that's going on with our Korban, our great Korban, which is in the Messiah. Never lose sight of that at all, because we think, oh, well, I'm glad I don't have to do that anymore. Well, something to meditate on is that this is what Messiah is doing for you and has done for you. That way in through the veil, you know, was as disgusting, you might say, as all the stuff we read about here in Leviticus. It was horrific, horrifically bad, horrifically, you know, gut-wrenching. You go through all the adjectives you want to say about what the Messiah did, not only in stooping down to be among mankind, but also then being God and offering himself up as the Korban, as the way in. That's something that we should never, ever, ever forget, which is why when you see it, in Hebrews 10:27, it's talking about, well, if you forsake this sacrifice, if you forsake your high priest, you forsake your way in, there's no other way in. You're left back in Exodus chapter 40 again, with you're sitting on the outside of God's presence and there's no way in. If you forsake God's way in, there is no other way in. Not getting in any other way. Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's Let's take a look at our first Haftarah here in 2 Samuel chapter 6. Be kind of dropping into this momentarily just to give another aspect of what you might say might seem like just a completely capricious and not a seemingly meaningless smiting that God did against one of his priests. You think of just some sort of slight thing that a priest actually looked like he was trying to help. You know, why did he deserve this? Yes, and you had a question?
It's coming up, and maybe you'd be talking about it soon, and that is those two men that were the uncle of Aaron's uncle's nephews or something, Mishael and Eliphaz or whatever his name was, to go in and take the bodies of the two Aaron's sons out of the holy place. They weren't destroyed for going in. Was it just because Moses said, these are the ones to go in or get
them? Yeah, basically they were given the permission to go in and remove them. Because you get the sense if they were where we think they might have been, you know, they needed extreme special permission to go in and remove them. So this passage that we're looking at here, you know, starts out with these chosen men, and it's about bringing the Ark of God. Yes, bringing the Ark of God, called by my name, the very name of the Lord of hosts, who is enthroned above the cherubim, we're talking about in the Ark itself. So, verse 3, they placed the Ark of God on a new cart, that they might bring it from the house of Aminadab, which was on a hill, and Uzzah and Ahio, the sons of Aminadab, were leading the cart. So you've got these folk who are leading this ark. The Ark of God was at someone's house, and now they're moving it into a better location, and they're putting it on a cart, and these two guys are walking ahead of it. Verse 5. Meanwhile, Dawid and all the house of Israel were celebrating before the Lord with all kinds of instruments made wood of fir with lyres and harps and tambourines and castanets and cymbals. But when they came to the threshing floor, Nacon, Uzzah reached out toward the ark and took hold of it, for the ox nearly upset it. The anger of the Lord burned against Uzzah, and God struck him down there for his irreverence, and he died there by the ark of God. Dawid became angry because of the Lord's outburst against Uzzah, and that place is called Perez Uzzah to this day. So you might remember, you know, Perez being the breach, because that guy who's named Perez, the one who broke forth, or the breach, or the dividing through. So this is place is called the Breach of Uzzah. So Dawid was afraid of the Lord that day, and he said, "How can the Ark of the Lord come to me?" Dawid was unwilling to move the Ark of the Lord into the city of Dawid with him. But Dawid took it aside to the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite. Thus the Ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite for 3 months. And the Lord blessed Obed-Edom and all his household. So it goes on there talking about this and the moving of it, but you're thinking of the real key part of this is start up there in verse 6 and verse 7, that Uzzah reached out toward the Ark of God and took hold of it, for the ox nearly upset it. So you get this picture that the Ark was on this cart and it kind of jostled. Well, some things that you might say some red flags in this account. First off is that the Ark is in some guy's house. First off, versus a tabernacle of some sort. That should be kind of the one thing first off. Number two, they stuck it on a cart. Now, a cart versus the way that God, we had read some instructions in Exodus and such about how the ark was put together, and it was to be carried on poles, and the poles would be kept attached so that you'd have the priests in each corner carrying it. Because, you know, you might have seen some old movies of, and even today, the idea of the sedan chair with somebody, some dignity, or something of honor, either a person or an item of honor being carried on a platform by people. You know, that is, in a whole lot of different cultures, seen as an example of bestowing some great honor. Because it's like you have people who are below the person who is being honored, the person whose honor being lifted up. Yeah, Bill, you have a question.
I was just wondering, what would have happened if nobody tried to stop that ark from falling? It did fall on the ground.
I guess that would be an interesting question.
Oops.
Would it have fallen?
Yeah. What would it kill everybody around there then, or what?
It's one of those things about you see another account of when the ark was used as a lucky charm in battle. Is things weren't going well, so they decided to, other things aren't working, let's bring out the ark, because that worked before. So they decided to use it as a lucky charm, and they lost it. And so the Philistines ended up with it. The sad part was that the Philistines at least bestowed far more honor upon the ark than even the Israel had at that time. At least they put it in a temple of some sort. You could say maybe they were trying to use it as just a war trophy for their deity, but at least they realized where power was and where it was coming from, because when things were started to come badly for them, they realized, we need to return it. So the sad part is that you saw the returning part of the ark, and the returning part was on a cart too. But yes. Oh, yeah, that's an interesting point. They might have decided, hey, the Philistines did it, we could do it too. Yes.
I heard some discussion, too, that with all the gold that ark was made out of...
Weighed a lot.
It weighed like 2,500 pounds.
Probably top-heavy, too.
So there was talk about how when it's put on the poles, the Holy Spirit carried it.
Yeah, I know
because
there's
it's too heavy for man to carry.
Talking about tradition, traditionally they said the priests didn't even walk. They just kind of floated along. They were actually holding on as the ark was floating and they were being carried by it. Yeah, various accounts of it. But it's one of those interesting pictures of, you know, the idea of the sedan chair is that you are lifting something up. A cart, no matter what culture you're talking about, carts are for cargo. It's like, you know, whether you're taking in agricultural stuff or this or that, it's for cargo, not something of honor on a cart. Now, you might say like a nice carriage or something like that, but you're not getting, the terminology here is not about a carriage or some sort of thing of honor. It's about a cargo vehicle that is moving this ark. So that's one of those cases too. So you see that there are many, many levels of the ark. Now, when you think about the ark itself, what is the ark? It's a box. It's a pretty box, as you mentioned, with a whole lot of gold on it, weighed a whole lot. But again, you know, it's a dead weight without some sort of specialness put on it. Because things that are special get that specialness because of, you know, what they represent. And you know, you might think of just on a purely monetary thing, okay, yeah, that's a whole lot of gold, so that gives it special honor. But the honor of having your protective zone around it, that's something even more. Now, that protective zone around it was because of what? Because of the box? Or because of the presence of God, the presence of God with the box. And as it even mentions here in this passage here, like in verse 2, the very name of the Lord of hosts who is enthroned above the cherubim, of the ark. So that sense that the presence of God traveling with the ark is what conveys that. And as we've talked about with the construction of the ark is all about containing the testimony. In fact, most often, it's called the Ark of the Testimony. In the Torah, that's the most often the name for it. Now, the testimony is all about who God is. So when you think about the presence of God, there's lots of cultures that have ideas about the presence of a powerful deity. Okay, that's great. Who is the deity? What does the deity want? What does the deity want from you about this or that? What is the deity that's different from any other deity in the world? People can guess and come up with stuff, and you know, you'll see records throughout time of the priesthood of various cultures coming up with various stories about what their deity is all about. Now, what's special here is you're talking about the testimony of the deity, the God of Israel, creator of heaven and earth, is revealing himself in this testimony. This testimony is a revelation of who he is. So when we talk about these tablets are the testimony. Now, something else that's really good to remember in this is that this testimony is only the tablets of the testimony, the box that it travels in, are only important because of what they communicate and what they represent and what they do. Not just in the box, the rock, the carvings in the rock, whatever that is. Well, one of the things that it kind of gets to the point where some people may misunderstand a bit is something that Paul mentions in 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 6, when he says, "The letter kills, but the Spirit gives life." Now, just a closer look at the context of this, I think, is really helpful. The context of this is really verses 2 through 10. So 2 Corinthians chapter 3, 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 2 through 10. "You are our letter, written in our hearts, known and read by all men, being manifested that you are a letter of Christ, cared for by us, written not with ink, but with the Spirit of the living God, not on tablets of stone, but on tablets of human hearts. Such confidence we have through Christ toward God. Not that we are adequate in ourselves to consider anything as coming from ourselves, but our adequacy is from God, who made us adequate as servants of a new covenant, not of the letter, but of the Spirit. For the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. But if the ministry of death in letters engraved on stones came with glory, so that the sons of Israel could not look intently upon the face of Moshe because of the glory of his face, fading as it was, how will the ministry of the Spirit fail to be even more with glory? For if the ministry of condemnation is glory, how much more does the ministry of righteousness abound in glory? For indeed, what had glory in this case has no glory because of the glory that surpasses it." One of the key points in here is that, you know, if you fixate upon the, you could say, the form that something comes through, then, and not get the meaning or the what is actually being communicated, you know, it becomes like as if nothing. It's talking about that which has no glory. The glory is not in rock or scribblings on the rock. It is in what they represent, because otherwise it becomes an artifact, a relic, put it in a museum, kind of put it under glass, look at it, take pictures of it, you know, take selfies with them, whatever you want to do. But it's not anything that has any real value. It's what it actually communicates. So it's like you can have replicas of the tablets on your wall. That's fantastic if they actually have some meaning. Otherwise, they're decoration. So that's one of the key things to really keep in mind with this is, and like we mentioned earlier about the korbanot, if the korbanot are not brought with the connection that the person who brings it in their heart want to actually draw near to the object or what where they're wanting to draw near to, you know, God says, get these out of my face. I don't want them. This is not what I want. I don't want animals. I don't want stuff going up in smoke. It only is a soothing, smoothing, or pleasant smell in his nostrils, because it is really the heart that's coming through, the intent, the yearning of the people that's coming through. That's what is soothing. That's what is great, smells great, not burning hair and such like that. That's one of the real key things to remember in this. So as we close out this section here, looking at this Haftarah, this little slight detour that we took, it's a little bit of a similar situation to what we're seeing there back in Leviticus chapter 10, is that this, we have a situation where someone was deviating from what God had talked about. And you might say, well, these people were these two sons of Aharon. Well, they were just ignorant. They didn't know. I mean, you know, if you were to think of chronological revelation, that perhaps, you know, they hadn't gotten the instructions on Leviticus 16 yet, but they'd already had the instructions of what we have recorded in Exodus 40 and Exodus or Leviticus, you know, 1 through 7 and 8. The fact that presence of God, not something you just go into anytime you want to. You don't just go up to it. When God moves in, you get out unless you have permission to get back in. And then giving a pretty defined way of how you get back into God's presence. So with that, that should have been a little bit of a clue that we should approach the presence of God with respect and the way that the presence is to be approached. So that's one of the lessons in both of those cases, chapter 10 and in 2 Samuel here, 6 and 7, is that, you know, treat God's presence with respect because of what this presence represents. Not that there's anything special in the object or whatever itself. It's the meaning that God puts into it and the purpose that he puts into these things, the goal in mind of what he's getting at. And just as with sterile procedure or hazardous materials or whatever, pay attention to what's going on. This is, as we start into our discussion of chapter 11 in Leviticus here with the clean and unclean, this is really what the lesson is with the clean and unclean for the next several chapters here through chapter 15, really. Clean and unclean. It's all about paying attention to what's going on around you. Pay attention to the things that are in God's realm and things that are not in God's realm. Because some of them may appear quite the same, but you have to pay close attention to them. So, let's move on then into chapter 11 of Leviticus. So, some things to talk about first off is the words that we encounter a lot in this particular chapter is tahor and tameh. Tahor is what is translated oftentimes clean, and tameh is translated oftentimes as unclean. Now, with these, you might get this picture in some translations will sometimes communicate this, that clean is holy. You know, you might just say, you know, tahor equals holy. Tahor equals clean and clean equals holy. And tameh equals unclean and unclean equals evil or wicked or something like that. So you might start thinking, okay, this is this distinction, the clean and unclean. So thus you're talking about the holy and the unholy and the wicked, things that are evil and such like that. Well, the question is, and we'll start seeing that as the chapters roll along, is that these two words, the tahor and tameh, are applied to some things that you're like, well, what on earth is wicked about that? I mean, we're talking about that some people, if they have certain conditions, you might say leprosy or something of that akin, some sort of tragic skin disease or something, they're tamei. And, you know, you might say, well, are they wicked in and of themselves? And, yeah, there might have been some sort of judgment, but we can't just make that assertion that someone is being judged by God just because they have some sort of horrific condition. And in the same sort, with tahor, you're saying that some of the things that are clean, quickly, you might notice that the tahor, things can move from tahor to tameh just by contact. Go from clean to unclean just by contact of it, but not the other way. The only other way that that works is with the washing. You'd say various instructions related to the washing and the purification periods and then the korbanot and various things like that. One of the things that you'll notice in a lot of these discussions of tahor and tameh is there. We're talking about in or the relations of the tabernacle themselves. And, you know, you're unclean until evening. And especially when we get into some of the discussions related to some of the appointed times and clean and unclean, that these are things that you don't go into the presence of God in a tame condition. You don't go into God's presence in that. So, more broadly defined of tahor and tameh, some translations even sometimes reflect this, is basically the tahor, or commonly translated clean, might be more broadly translated as unfit to approach. And, or I should say, fit to approach. Thank you. Hello. Tameh is the unfit to approach. So that might be a better way to look at these, because we're talking in the context of approaching God. So this is thrown in here. You might say, well, is this kind of random, this stuff just thrown in here? Well, this is really all about approaching God and drawing near to God. So thus, the tahor and tameh is also about approaching God. And the things that happen, and there's all kinds of different scenarios that we'll see in the next few chapters about things that happen in life that cause a hiccup, a disruption in approaching God. And, you know, we'll, as we mentioned there before, skin conditions, you know, you got men's cycles can leave them with a blockage in approaching God. Women's cycles can leave them in childbirth. Various things that show up. You say, well, that's like no fault of any particular person. Things just happen. That's the way bodies operate and such. And these are things that are leave this bit of a blockage in approaching God. Now, there have been a number of people through time, and more in recent times, that have thrown up this thing of saying, well, you know, you have people who have, you know, some sort of a deformity or something. They, if they're a priest, they can't serve in the tabernacle because they would be kind of in the category of tameh. So, is that their fault? So they now barred? I mean, what kind of a vindictive God is this that you're saying that you cannot approach him if you're in a state of tamein and you had nothing to do with it? It's just that's what happened to you. Yeah, birth defect or, you know, an accident or something, you know, something happened to you and you're less than fully fit. Yeah. It's not that you're bad, but you're just not able to serve in that capacity. Because one of the things that is being presented with this is God's presence among mankind, and there are the transition of people around the outside who want to come into the presence of God. And the priesthood, and the high priest being the key part of that, is like the ultimate of the ultimate representatives of the people to go back and forth between them. Boy, that does sound familiar. It sounds a lot like what we read about with Yeshua in there, and the Messiah. It being the key, the Son of Man, the super typical Son of Man, who is the conduit between heaven and earth. And the description of the ladder on which, you know, the angels descend up and down with, on the Son of Man. So that is what the priesthood, and that is what all this clean and unclean is representing, is that there is this connection that God is wanting to have with mankind, and you need to have the super typical representative is going to have to make that connection between one and the other. But you'll also notice in a lot of these cases with the Tomei situation is that, you know, it's not like a terrible thing that it might, especially for some of the more temporary ones, you know, you wash, you're unclean until evening, and then that's the end of it. It's one of those cases where it becomes an issue is that if you are in a Tomei situation and then you go into the presence of God, that's where the issue comes in. Yeah, then that's a pretty serious one of acting in a pretty bold and, you could say, pretty arrogant situation. Now, that's one of those cases we'll see later of what happens and when you have the unintentional situation and one of those unintentional things of discovering that you're Tomei or something like that. Then that comes into a different category. One of the things that is really good to take a look at this point is the punchline, you might say, of this particular section, which are the last few verses of this chapter. 44, 45, and 44 through 47, really. For I am the Lord your God. Consecrate, meaning separate yourselves, therefore, and be holy, be separate, for I am separate, I am holy. And you shall not make for yourselves unclean with any of the swarming things that swarm on the earth. And kind of a summary of what's gone before. For I am the Lord your God, who brought you up from the land of Mitzrayim to be your God. Thus you shall be holy, for I am holy. Kind of a key point is that remember that this God is the one who separated Israel from Mitzrayim, from Egypt, from that house of slavery. So God has made consecrated Israel, taken Israel out of that situation, made it separate, made it distinct from where it was before. And now God is saying, I'm the one who's separate. I'm the one who's holy. I'm the one who's totally different from the deities of Egypt or anybody else that is able to do this, to able to free you, part the Red Sea, et cetera, to do these mighty things. So just as I am so separate from anything else around you, anything else on earth, so then you be separate from the things of earth. But one of the other lessons of this clean and unclean, the tahor and tameh, is that you're going to be around all kinds of things that can, quote, corrupt, unquote, things that are can block, come in between you and God. They're going to happen all around you all the time. So keep a watch out for these things. So one of the things that another haftarah or little branch that we're going to be taking a look at is Acts chapters 10 and 11. And you might recognize this includes the vision here of Peter, and often called like the yes, the blanket or the vision of the unclean animals, various ways that this is described. Yes. So we're the idea of clean and unclean, the tahor and tameh, shows up here Again, we should be looking for the punchline. What is this really talking all about? So Acts chapter 10. Now there was a man at Caesarea named Cornelius, a centurion, who was called of what was called the Italian cohort, a devout man who feared God with all his household and gave many alms to the Jewish people and prayed to God continually. And at about the ninth hour of the day, he clearly saw in a vision an angel of God who had just come in and said to him, Cornelius, and fixing his gaze on him and being much alarmed, he said, What is it, Lord? He said to him, Your prayers and alms have ascended as a memorial before God. Now dispatch some men to Joppa and send for a man named Simon, who is called Peter. He is staying with a tanner named Simon, whose house is by the sea. When the angel who was speaking to him had left, he summoned two of his servants and a devout soldier of those who were his personal attendants. And after he had explained everything to them, he sent them to Joppa. On the next day, as they were on their way and approaching the city, Peter went up on the housetop at about the sixth hour to pray. But he became hungry and was desiring to eat. But while they were making preparations, he fell into a trance. And he saw the sky opened up and an object like a great sheet coming down, lowered by its four corners to the ground. And there were in it all kinds of four-footed animals and crawling creatures on the earth and birds of the air. And a voice came to him, Get up, Peter, kill and eat. But Peter said, By no means, Lord, for I have never eaten anything unholy and unclean. Tame. Again, a voice came to him a second time. What God has cleansed, tahor, no longer consider tame, or unholy. This happened three times, and immediately the object was taken up in the sky. Now, while Peter was greatly perplexed in mind as to what the vision which he had seen might be, behold, the men who had been sent by Cornelius, having asked directions for Shimon's house, appeared at the gate, and calling out, they were asking whether Shimon, who was also called Peter, was staying there. While Peter was reflecting on the vision, the Spirit said to him, Behold, three men are looking for you. But get up, go downstairs and accompany them without misgivings, for I myself have sent them. Peter went down to the men and said, Behold, I am the one you're looking for. What is the reason you have come? They said, Cornelius, a centurion, a righteous and God-fearing man, well spoken of by the entire nation of the Jews, was divinely directed by a holy angel to send for you to come to his house and hear a message from you. So he invited them in and gave them lodging. And on the next day, he got up and went away with them. And some of the brethren from Joppa accompanied him. On the following day, he entered Caesarea. Now Cornelius was waiting for them and called together his relatives and close friends. When Peter entered, Cornelius met him and fell at his feet and worshipped him. But Peter raised him up, saying, Hey, stand up. I too am just a man. As he talked with him, he entered and found many people assembled. And he said to him, You yourselves know how unlawful it is for a man who is a Jew to associate with a foreigner or to visit with him. And yet God has shown me that I should not call any man unholy or unclean. That is why I came without even flashing or raising objection when I was sent for. So I asked for what reason you have come to send me. Cornelius said, 4 days ago at this hour, I was praying in my house during the ninth hour. And behold, a man stood before me in shining garments. And he said, Cornelius, your prayer has been heard and your alms have been remembered before God. Therefore, send to Joppa and invite Shimon, who is called Peter, to come to you. He is staying in the house of Shimon the tanner by the sea. So I sent for you immediately, and you have been kind enough to me. Now then, we are all here present before God to hear all that you have been commanded by the Lord. Opening his mouth, Peter said, I certainly understand now that God is not one to show partiality, but in every nation, the man who fears him and does what is right is welcome to him. The word which he sent to the sons of Israel, preaching peace through Yeshua the Messiah, He is Lord of all. You yourselves know the thing which took place throughout all Judea, starting from Galilee after the baptism which Yohanan proclaimed. You know of Yeshua of Nazareth, who God anointed him with the Holy Spirit and with power, and how he went about doing good and healing all who were oppressed by the devil, for God was with him. We are witnesses of all the things he did in the land of the Jews and in Jerusalem. They also put him to death by hanging him upon a cross, but God raised him up on the third day and granted that he become visible, not to all people, but to witnesses who were chosen beforehand by God, that is, to us who ate and drank with him after he arose from the dead. So this continues on and gets recounted a couple more times as we go on through into chapter 11, as he repeats this to some elders. And one of the things that is really important to look at this is, like, in chapter 11, verse 18, mentions there that the elders who had heard what Peter's testimony was, and they glorified God, saying, "Well then, God has granted to the nations also the repentance that leads to life." One of the key points that we have in this whole passage is really that God is lifting up the nations. And rather than just saying, okay, there is no more distinction between what is clean and unclean, he had taken what was, quote, unclean and lifted it up. One of the things that Peter makes mention of there in passing in chapter 10, verse 28, "You yourselves know how unlawful it is for a man who is a Jew to associate with a foreigner or to visit him." And that's one thing that you do see in the Mishnah as an extrapolation upon Tahor and Tameh, saying basically, yeah, you don't even eat with anyone from the nation, someone who is in that Tameh category, because that then will make you Tameh if you just eat with somebody.
Is that what you're saying? There's a lot of people that say, see, they were doing the Torah. And it's like, no, they were doing tradition.
Yeah, that particular part,
so
was a tradition.
That is not in the Torah to be found. It's in the oral tradition, yeah, rabbinical tradition. To not eat with them.
Yeah, but you know, it's one of those things that you could say is a lesson that was learned perhaps too well. It is one of the key lessons, and we'll be getting to this even more, is the distinction of the things that kind of block you or hinder you in approaching God versus the things that help you or allow you to approach God. If you are not looking out for that as the key lesson, then you start thinking that then it is just by the contact, that things in and of themselves are unclean. Just like the tradition was noting that if you eat with somebody, their uncleanness will jump onto you. One of the key lessons of the Tahor and the Tameh is that there is a distinction, but it is not actually, you know, something that is intrinsic in and of itself. It is something that God has made a distinction of it. You might say, sometimes it's a bit arbitrary of a distinction, but he's saying he's making a distinction on it and saying this is in the tahor, the clean, the fit category, and this is in the tameh, the unfit category. You know I come from a tradition that has gone on at length trying to figure out why God made some things tahor and some things tameh. And let me tell you, you're going to run into all kinds of problems if you try to come up with that. For example, I grew up with the idea that the pig is tameh because of trichinosis and unhealthy and stuff like that. Well, the chicken is tahor and salmonella. How many outbreaks of salmonella do we have? Lots. A lot more than trichinosis these days. So When you start going on and on and on, okay, you could say the things about the carrion and the birds of prey and the scavengers of the sea and various things like that. But in some cases, they're just a distinction. And one of the things that you talk about with the cloven hooves and the passage there in chapter 11 makes clear that the pig has got the cloven hooves, but it doesn't chew the cud. And people have kind of taken the lesson in that and kind of extrapolated the lesson out saying, ah, well, that's perhaps a good lesson of saying things may not always appear to be something that's good for you. Just at the outset, you might just take a look at something and not realize that it is really something that's blocking you or taking you away from it. We might think in today's culture about the internet. People will throw rocks at the internet and they'll give it a big warm hug because of what it can do and the greatness. I mean, just think about how many of us have come to learn lots more about God because of the internet. You know, I mean, videos and teachings, all kinds of stuff. The messaging, I mean, can you imagine of all the congregations that we read about here in Acts and wherever, if they had email or texting, I mean, can you imagine what kind of mighty things could be done just through those various things? But then again, you know, the internet is also a big fire hose of all kinds of things that can take you totally away from God's presence and make you not even want to be in God's presence. So those things, it's one of those things that you just have to look at it in the distinction of what brings you closer to God and what doesn't. And the you could say the spiritual discipline of the Tahor and Tameh is a teaching you to be careful in what it is that you look for. Not so much in the case of that it will just make you healthier. In some cases that could be true. But that to be careful, watch what it is that you're doing. When we eat, that's something we do frequently. So imagine the care that you do in that. Well, what are the other things that we do frequently? We talk to people. We interact with our coworkers, our friends, our family. You know, how closely are we watching in our interactions with people? What we say to people? Are they in that tahor or tamei category? And the things that we say to people, are they helping people into God's presence or blocking them from being into God's presence or blocking ourselves from being in God's presence? It's kind of like what Yeshua said to some of the leaders. He said, you know, you block people from the kingdom of heaven and you yourselves don't go in. So in that case, wow, it's a double fail. So one of those things that we see with this is the nations. It's one of the key lessons here of Acts chapter 10 and 11. Just like we're saying with the Tahor and Tameh, is that God is making the distinction. The nations out there and the kingdom of God. But God is taking from the nations and lifting up. And we should not just look on the outside and say, oh, okay, I see cloven hooves. Okay, that must be clean. Oh my goodness, no it's not. Or the opposite. Oh, that looks like it's unclean. Wow. Actually, it is because God has changed the category of it. You know, it's one of those things that God puts the discipline in place for us to pay attention to what it is that we're doing. But we should always see that perhaps we are having prejudices that God doesn't have. And specifically in the talking about what is actually, you know, God bringing in the nations into the kingdom. One of those key passages that really fits along with this passage we're just looking at is in Ephesians chapter 2. And we'll just kind of close out our discussion here today looking at Ephesians chapter 2, because this is hugely important. If you don't get anything else out of what we're talking about today, look at what it is about the whole korban, the bringing near to God. Because remember, that's what korban means. That's what the offerings are all about, is to get closer to God. And the Tameh and Tahor is talking about what things block and what things help get closer to God. So we're going to be looking in Ephesians chapter 2. All right, so we're just going to start from the beginning. We're going to be primarily looking through pretty much this chapter. It's with Paul's things, they're very hard to drop into. So we're going to be taking a look at the chapter 2 as a whole, but keying into one particular verse in verse 13. You know, in Messiah Yeshua, you who were formerly far off have been brought near, Korban, by the blood of Christ. Far off, brought near. And there's a quotation in here from Isaiah chapter 57, which is talking about this. We'll get into that a little bit more. So Ephesians chapter 2. And you who were dead in your trespasses and sins, in which you were formerly walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, of the spirit that is now working in the sons of disobedience. Among them, we too all formerly lived in the lusts of our flesh, indulging the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, even as the rest. But God, being rich in mercy, because of his great love, which he loved us, even when we were dead in our transgressions, made us alive together with Messiah. By grace you have been saved, and raised us up with him, and seated us with him in the heavenly places in Messiah Yeshua, so that in the ages to come he might show the surpassing riches of his grace and kindness toward us in Messiah Yeshua. For by grace you have been saved through faith, and that not of yourselves. It is the gift of God, not as a result of works, so that no one may boast. For we are his workmanship, created in Messiah Yeshua for good works, which God prepared beforehand so that we would walk in them. Remember, therefore, that formerly you, the Gentiles in the flesh, who are called uncircumcision by the so-called circumcision, which is performed in the flesh by human hands, remember that you were at a time separate from Messiah, excluded from the commonwealth of Israel, and strangers to the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. But now in Messiah Yeshua, you who were formerly far off, that's kind of in the Tom A category, you who were formerly far off have been brought near by the blood of Messiah. For he himself is our peace, who made both groups into one and broke down the barrier of the dividing wall by abolishing in his flesh the enmity, which is the law of commandments contained in ordinances, so that in himself he might make the two into one new man, thus establishing peace, and might reconcile them both into one body to God through the cross, by it having put to death the enmity. And he came and preached peace to you who were far away, and peace to you who were near. It's a quotation from Isaiah 57. For through him we have both our access in one spirit to the Father. So then, you are no longer strangers and aliens, but you are fellow citizens with the saints and are God's household, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Messiah Yeshua himself being the cornerstone, in whom the whole building being fitted together is growing into the holy temple in the Lord, in whom you are being built together into a dwelling of God in the Spirit. Wow! That's fantastic. That is what is happening both in Acts chapter 10, 11, and this whole lesson here of the clean and the unclean and the tahor and the tameh. That which was far off being brought near. Now, we don't have time to venture into Isaiah 57, but Paul here is quoting this in the context of the Gentiles or the people of the nation. People who are not born into, you know, Israel by birth or by accession, or you might say conversion or something. These are what you commonly hear is called God-fearers. That's what Cornelius is referred to as. People who fear God, respect God highly, hold him up as being the creator, you know, the God. I mean, you think of, it's, this guy must have been, had a whole lot of clout to be a centurion and be a God-fearer. As, you know, you hear a lot of writings about what the Romans thought about the God of Israel, and it wasn't nice. It wasn't nice at all. Some of the writings of chief historians of Rome just scoff at the belief at all because it's so antithetical, so against the Greek and Roman pantheon, just totally what that's all about. So Cornelius, talk about a man of trust, trusted God a lot. And you could see that it filtered down to everybody who was under his command and his community, because when Peter showed up, there was all kinds of people who came over to his house to hear what he had to say. So obviously Cornelius was telling quite a lot of people about what he was learning. But one of the key things in there is that verse 19 that we had read in chapter 2 of Ephesians. Fellow citizens, there's no second class thing. This one new man, this bringing everybody into the commonwealth of Israel. There's not like the second class citizen, this keeping these people far off. That dividing wall is what Yeshua brought down. Those who are far off being brought near. Because when you read Isaiah 57, it's not about Gentiles. It is about the exiles of Israel. God considered even Israel far off. And he brought Israel near out of exile. They, you know, because remember the prophets who talked about those who were not my people have been called my people. Now, that applied both to Israel and those of the nations as well. So that's when you see Peter and then Paul and these folks talking about, you know, why are we making these distinctions against these people? God didn't. He even brought Israel back in after divorcing Israel, sending Israel away into exile and captivity. So that's one of the great promises that we have, is that this distinction still exists, and it's a great discipline that we have, but we should be very careful in excluding people from the dwelling place of God if God has brought them in. Not that God is totally dropping, you could say lowering the bar, so to speak, but God is, like he does with everybody, lifts them up and carries them over the bar. He does that with everybody. Does that with those who are native born. Does that with the sojourner. Does that with the alien. Does that with the God-fearer. Everybody gets over the bar the same way. And that's one thing that we always remember. And when in Leviticus, when we get to chapter 16, that becomes very, very clear. Everybody goes into the Holy of Holies the same way through the high priest. And the high priest being a picture, and you see in Hebrews, of the great high priest who he is his own korban, doesn't need a korban for him. He is his own korban. So, any last thoughts as we close out today? So, one of those great things that we have in this picture of what God is doing is, this is not plan A, plan B God here, you know, that kind of plan B starting in Matthew and continuing on. This is all plan A. This is something that's been going from the very beginning. And God has been compensating for our weaknesses through his mercy.
So Hebrew talks a lot about Yeshua as our high priest, and it also talks a lot about what's the name of that high priest when Lot
Melchizedek.
Had got Melchizedek. It's mm-hmm. like a Melchizedek priesthood.
Yes.
That is real strong in Hebrews.
Mm-hmm. Very much so.
Is that the new priesthood, and we're not to be going by the Levitical anymore?
That is. And in Hebrew discussion, it's called a kal v'chomor. It's a light to heavy. It
light
is a
to what?
Light to heavy.
Light to heavy?
Yes. That's the literal translation. What it means is you'll see Yeshua use this in his teachings. You'll see in his parables and such. It is also something that Paul uses a lot, and it's very heavy in Hebrews. What it means is, okay, you understand this to be true. Well, how much more is this? So that's what the discussion. You have the Levitical priesthood. How much more is the Melchizedek, which is not dependent upon the tabernacle? You know, that's the point of it. Not saying that the tabernacle and everything the Levitical priesthood did is of no account and completely irrelevant. It's saying that the Melchizedek order, the order after Melchizedek, is not dependent upon this tabernacle temple being standing, because it is connected directly to the real tabernacle that was patterned after. That's the point of it. It's not saying the other one is of no good.
That is part of what I wanted to know. But we don't have the temple. We don't have the Levitical priesthood anymore. But we still, I believe, are required to know the Torah, because that's going to be kind of like our rules and regulations for our new world to live in once Messiah returns, right?
And right here, because what is the last verse of the last couple of verses of Ephesians chapter 2 talk about? Yes, the dwelling place of God still exists. Yeah. Doesn't have an address in Yerushalayim at the moment, but it still exists. There's actually quite a few of them here in this room. And we're all a part of one big building. And that big building is talked about in many different ways, of Yeshua being the temple, we all being a part of one big building with Yeshua as the cornerstone, lots of different ways that's... Basically, the idea is that the dwelling place of God is with man. And that is something that Yeshua really brought into really a bit of fullness. Now, that is going to meet its great actualization. The prophets talked about it. Revelation talks about it, where the actual presence of God is going to be here with mankind. You know, and, you know, that whole, the Korban process is already finished. We have access in. It's going to be fully realized when God's presence is here with us and we see God face to face. You know, because our korbans brought everything to a completion. That separation, necessary as it has been, won't be necessary anymore.
Well, is not the sin of the golden calf, while a lot of that law was in place and the Melchizedek priesthood was Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that they followed, and then we go back to, if I'm saying that right.
Well, we do see the one who that's patterned after, the Melchizedek there, the king of Salem. You see him showing up in Abraham's time, and Abraham does bring the offering.
But isn't Christ, was he not made when he came up out of the water and he said, "This is my son who I'm well pleased"? Did he not give him back the priesthood order? Did Christ take that Melchizedek order?
It talks
back?
About an anointing, whether you have that anointing at that particular time. You do get a picture of different types of anointings. Yeshua coming through time. Now, you know, talking about any particular point in time, you could say that Yeshua was anointed at the time of Isaiah and Jeremiah, because that's when God was pointing, saying, "This is what I'm going to do." So that anointing was really in place. And since we're talking about someone who pre-existed at that point in time, you know, that anointing. And then when you see, like in Revelation, when it talks about the Lamb was sacrificed from the beginning of the world. So you're saying, well, this is something that's been in God's time frame, where time becomes irrelevant. It happened, it will happen, it has happened.
But it's not because of the golden calf that, because of the sin of the golden calf, that's not, because it says put the commandments the Ark of the Covenant is the covenant, not the Ark of the Law. It's the Ark of the Covenant. Is that?
Oh, the Ark of the Covenant? It's the box.
I mean, the sin of the golden calf was because all the, I mean, there was things that were added because of the sin of the golden calf, right? That's how they broke, when they did that calf, when they made that idol.
Oh,
not take them out of the Melchizedek priesthood? And it was, I thought, because Messiah was,
Is the question about the Levitical priesthood coming in because of the golden calf?
Right.
Okay.
That's why.
Yeah, because
the Levitical priesthood we were going to be kings and priests, but because of the sin of the golden calf, that's what made the Levitical priesthood.
Yeah, I've heard some people will say that, kind of extrapolating on what Paul was saying in Romans about the law was added because of transgression.
Right.
That basically God inflicted the Torah upon mankind because of the golden calf,
right,
and such like that.
That idol.
Well, the point was is that they were headed to Sinai, to hang out. The whole point of the Torah was the goal of where they were going. It wasn't just like, oh crud, we're on to plan B. And so plan A didn't work, so now we have to add plan B at Sinai. But what we see is the revelation, because it's really not just the Ark of the Covenant, it's the Ark of the Testimony. This is a revelation of who God is. So God wanted to reveal himself throughout time. He keeps revealing himself to Abraham, you know, to Moses. All throughout time, he's revealing himself. So at Sinai, this was a revelation. This was a testimony of who God is versus any of the other deities out there in the world saying, okay, this is the one who took you out. Because remember what the first statement is. I'm the Lord your God who took you out. Okay, that is the statement. This is the testimony. That is true regardless of the golden calf. It doesn't matter if the golden calf, because the first statement is, I am the one who took you out. Because that's relevant even to the time of, you know, Rahab there at Jericho. Because she heard that, not only of the taking out of Egypt, but crossing the Red Sea and taking out the Egyptian army and stuff like that. That message of who God is relevant, golden calf or not. Golden calf was, you could say, a major falling down. But when you talk about the mercy of God, the mercy of God was really displayed and, you could say, also exemplified in the transformation of Moshe. Because remember, Moshe interceded with God and said, please, spare them. And did that repeatedly with that. And that... that's one of the reasons why he's called a friend of God. The reason why he's called a friend of God is that really got to know who God was. This thing that he had asked for, and he said, show me your glory. And then God passed and talked about who he was. He gave a testimony of who he was. That's important, golden calf or not. So... It's one of those things of the Levitical priesthood, again, getting access into God's presence. And that's hugely important, golden calf or not.
So is the Melchizedek priesthood, the priesthood that's going to be reigning when he actually comes back down and is with us once again, that will be the priesthood? Because Leviticus is gone now, right?
Well, it talks about the Levitical priesthood only has any sort of meaning with the temple. Now, you know, whether there will be a Ezekiel's temple or third temple or whatever you want to call that or not, whether it's physical, whether it is a teaching of what we are as the temple of God, regardless of that, the Levitical priesthood is working in the context of bringing the Korban in. Now, at the moment, we'll have to see what God does. in whether we still need that korban system. But at this moment, that's one of the lessons of Hebrews, is that we do have the korban, whether there is a physical tabernacle or not. We are not left without any sort of, we are not left without a sacrifice. Because, yeah, like I was talking about before, because if you disregard Yeshua as the korban, there is no other way in.
Okay, so that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
So if the Messiah is without me, then the Levitical priesthood is over with.
You could say it's been faded away, yes.
Let's put it that way. They're not practicing, they're not doing the sacrifices.
Put on hold. I hate to say it, but they've suspended their activities. Their activities have been suspended. Right, and that's one of the teachings of how much more. Not saying that what came before is of no value. Right. That's what I'm saying is that's what kind of gets confusing with the call of a homor method of teaching, is that it can make people think that what came before is gone, done away with, or whatever. But that's the passage we were looking at, you know, the letter kills, but the spirit gives life. It's not that the letter was not important or whatever, but put it in perspective of what it is. Put it in perspective.
In the new world, once Messiah comes back, we're not going to be sacrificing.
Because the dwelling place of God is with man. You don't need... And to get access to God, because we're going to be in His presence. That's one of those presences. Now, when we talk about the grain offerings and stuff, that is, you could say, on that realm of the free will offerings. You might mention that as something that is a bit of a thanksgiving or something like that. Well, you bring thanks a lot in Romans chapter 12, verse 1. It's offer yourselves as a living sacrifice. That's something you bring all the time. Now, we have our korban. That's always in place. But we still come as a living korban. Why? We don't need an intermediary. We don't need to hand it off to grain or an animal or something like that. That then goes into God's presence as blood. This, we go in because our way in has already been made clear, has already been made sure. That's why we go in with confidence. We're not going to end up like, you know, Nadab and Abihu and get burned up, or Uzzah and die because he touched God's presence, where God's presence was residing. That's the kind of confidence that we have. Well, let's wrap up here. Father God, we thank you for giving us this good news that we can come into your presence. But Father, we just ask for you to continually teach us through your Spirit that we should never treat your presence, you know, with kind of a nonchalant attitude. We should always just be respectful of who you are and the great mercy and gift that you've given us to be able to go into your presence with confidence. Because of the blood of your Son, Yeshua. And we thank you in His name. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. Hallel.info.